This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I remember seeing Dr. Joe Paul post earlier this year in a Facebook group asking other doctors to share their stories of disappointment at the hands of their employer, and the results were shocking. There are over 1,000 comments of doctors sharing experiences of what can only be called petty tortures. Now, this all stemmed from Joe tweeting about quitting medicine, which gained a huge response and snowballed into her putting together a dossier for the Royal Colleges on these issues. We all knew that being a doctor would require hard work and sacrifice, but we didn't know that the unsympathetic system would repeatedly require us to put work before key moments in our lives, repeatedly deny our leave requests, no matter the reason, and repeatedly prioritise sticking to rules over showing humanity, and inevitably reduce the human in its claws to just another doctor. So today I'm thrilled to invite Dr. Joe Paul onto the podcast and talk to us about what led her to that pivotal tweet and the journey that she's been on since.
Hello, Joe.
It's nice to be here.
So before you even got to like talking on this podcast, we've literally just done a tour of the wing. Yeah. And I feel like we've done that for about like 50 minutes now. And we finally found a place where we can sit and talk to you. So thank you so much for starting your journey so early this morning.
That's all right.
Yeah, that's amazing. You told us that you were up at 5 a.m. this morning to come into us. Thank you so much for that.
It's all right. It's been more than worth it. I've got some interior design inspiration.
Yeah, we've absolutely loved looking around the wing. It's been amazing.
Enjoyed that.
Yeah. So, Joe, I've obviously read your blog post, so I feel like I do know this, but can you start with sort of telling us about your journey into medicine, what motivated you, and how you ended up?
Yeah, sure. So initially I was wanted to do biochemistry and genetics because the Human Genome Project had just kind of come out when I was at secondary school, and I thought that was great.
I love like a real science
really
like geeky.
Because
there's not actually that many in medicine.
No. So my mum actually didn't think I should do medicine because she thought I was, you know, didn't like people enough. So I've obviously gone into anaesthetics.
Yeah.
I don't have to talk to them. But I went and did some work experience in a Wellcome Sanger Institute where they'd done part of the Genome Project
a
couple of days in Cambridge. And while I loved it, I also felt it's very dark. I actually did miss talking to people.
Mm.
And as my boyfriend at the time was applying for medicine, I was like, that sounds like a good idea. So a week before,
the peer pressure.
Yeah, I changed my personal statement to apply for medicine. So
that's a quick change.
Yeah.
A week before.
I'm very impulsive.
Do you ever think back to that time and you're like, how different could my life have been?
Yeah.
Like who knows?
It would, you know, I'd probably have gone down the genetic lab route and had a much quieter time.
Like your tweets might not be going viral. That's so funny. And in terms of medicine, when you started it at med school, how did you find it? Did you enjoy it? Like, what would you say your like personality was in med school?
Yeah, so I loved it, really. It was a combination of everything I enjoyed. And Oxford's a very traditional course. There's a lot of physics, a lot of genetics, a lot of sort of molecular mechanisms, which I loved.
Like, which college were you in?
So I did Merton College, which is where fun goes to die.
I was going to say, it's a super nerdy college, right?
Yeah, but I just like the garden. I look around and really like the gardens. So I was quite brooking myself when I found out it was the academic one. I was like, God, what? But really enjoyed it. had a lot of fun. I think I came out of my shell more because it wasn't weird to be geeky as a girl there.
True.
And sort of started finding myself, as one does at university.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then just remembered loving, we got one-on-one tutorials, so you'd get like a professor of this teaching you for an hour, which I found so, you know, stimulating. And then I went to Imperial halfway through.
For your clinical years.
For clinical, which I found a big adjustment, actually, I think.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Other than recently, that was probably the only other time I've kind of had second doubts. So I really researched looking into doing a neuroscience master's. And that was just, I think, just again, like, sudden loss of social structure.
Yeah.
I'm from a really tiny village that's overrun with sheep most of the time.
Oh,
Oxford's quite small. And then suddenly you're in London and I think... Exactly. And I think I had my phone, like, snatched off me by someone on, like, the
second
day. Like
a guy on a cycle type thing.
Yeah, literally.
Oh, how irritating.
I know.
That must have felt like, oh, this is what London's going to be for the rest of this year.
Yeah, honestly.
Actually, it wasn't a year. How long was it?
So it was 3 years.
And you're probably like, I'm over it. Someone's taking my phone, that's it, I'm moving back.
Literally. So it took a long time to settle in, actually. But I think it makes you more resilient, doesn't it? It makes you more resourceful. I did love clinical, actually. I didn't think I would. But I found it a shock going from writing essays. So all we did in Oxford was write essays. We didn't see patients and we didn't really do many sort of quick mark tests. It was essay based. So I really struggled in like the first year OSCEs.
Yeah.
You know, I just didn't know what to do with
people. Yeah. It's a whole different exam technique.
Yeah, like literally is. So I had to, like, it's the only time I kind of had to artificially prepare myself for exams. I kind of flamed through to that point. And then I just had to practice with housemates and on people. So I have a very clever housemate who went on to do ENT, actually, who pretty much made us all pass our finals because he practiced with
us. We all have that person.
I wish that was me, but
I'm just riding the wave. I'm riding that person's wave.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I can do what I'm interested in, but the other stuff less so.
And I thought it was interesting when you said at Oxford you had that like one-on-one tutorial and that relationship with
the
senior.
That's true. It's
how did you find... Was that one of the changes that you found difficult coming into London, or...?
You know what, now I've never thought about it before.
Welcome to my therapist's couch.
I love this. I guess it definitely is. Yeah. You've got someone who not only interviewed you to say, I'm going to accept you into the Oxford fold, saw something in you, and then mentored you pretty much on a very, you know, sometimes bi-weekly basis, coming in around their clinical job to come and chat to you for an hour. You know, they were tasking, certainly. Some of them are, you know, difficult characters, but you felt inspired, you felt mentored. And actually, yes, London, you're much more anonymous. You know, I was sort of an interloper, so I can understand people who started here might not feel the same.
Yeah.
But I did. And then that is what you feel when you enter training, isn't it? That you don't have that one person that kind of gets you and is seeing you progress and seeing you every week. You've suddenly lost that, which is actually quite interesting because it's probably one of the next hardest steps. Other than leaving home, isn't it?
So. Yeah, definitely. Because you're sort of, you know, you've sort of cut your ties from home, off you go to university, and then you feel like you've found your feet.
Yeah.
So, I always think the Oxbridge transfers that come into the London, because I was at King's, so we had Oxbridge transfers.
So you
transfers.
Saw the other side of it.
And you like they'd suddenly turn up on your first day of clinics and you'd be like, hey, who's that in the corner? Yeah. And then
in the corner, these London bullies. I'm so sorry, Jo.
Exactly what happened.
That is without their phones, like you know, and then as you go by, you sort of be like, oh, that's Oxbridge people.
Yeah,
okay,
but it takes a while because obviously once you're on clinical placements, you kind of go around with 4 to 6 people,
and you get
once.
To know a group.
Like,
and,
so you start sort of immersing yourself. It gets a bit exponential after that. But I did have fun by the end of it, but definitely it was like
an adjustment,
a big adjustment. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Okay, so med school. You grew, you were grown by the end, you were prepared, you were fully fledged.
Like I blossomed.
Foundation years.
Yeah.
So did you go sort of to Severn side, back closer to home? Or?
No, so I went back to Oxford. So I did an academic foundation, partly to give me control over
I just
geography.
Love how there's so much geek in your entire life.
Yeah.
It like literally gives
such
me
a
life.
Geek.
And what was your academic job in at the time?
So I did sort of, it was a critical care related academic. So it was at the Cadori Centre in Oxford, and it was sort of looking, it was really boring, but it was like lung protective ventilation basically, which is a massive deal if you're in anaesthetics and boring for everyone else. And I loved that, and it was partly because of the geography, because if you apply to an academic post, you know where you're going, as opposed to the main...
the usual
thing, you know, you can end up in Scotland, can't you? So I was like, no thanks.
Yeah.
So no from me.
Yeah, but my first F1 year was in Slough in Wexham Park.
Oh yeah.
Which was at the time in special measures, and I think at one point on your medical on-calls you were looking after over 300 people, you, and there was a registrar, but he was in A&E.
Like a clocking wretch.
That was the medical cover.
Oh,
that's wild.
Yeah. So halfway through that year, we had a forum and got a second person put in overnight.
Because madness.
It was crazy. Yes, it does build you and it builds strength of character, but I wouldn't say it was safe for patients.
No.
At the same time, you learn to manage stress.
It builds you in a way where you absolutely have no other choice.
Exactly.
Yeah,
which I think
there's no alternative.
Exactly, which is what annoys me. By the time people have made it to Regis or Parts Foundation, you have shown that you can do it.
Yeah.
Which is why when people do start to have bad time, there's probably a good reason.
Yeah.
And 100%. Can I ask, when you say that you reflected on those experiences at the time, and it also sounds like Oxford instilled a spirit of being able to reflect and think what's happened and how do I move
forward. That's when I was happiest in medicine as well. It made me realise what I enjoyed about it.
Mm. Okay.
Which I think gets lost.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm. How do you reflect on this is an absolute crazy situation that we're going through right now, having to look after 300 patients? And then what's your response to it? Or what was the response of the collective? Did everyone just kind of take it? Or?
Yeah, and that's the thing. Everyone takes it. Everyone takes everything in medicine. You know, you have really basic, stupid things. And we will moan about it in private to each other. But nobody is hang on a minute. This is not okay with capital letters.
Yeah.
Can we address this? It takes... People don't do that. They're too tired. It takes extracurricular activity. No one understands the system. As an F1, I don't know how the board worked or anything like that.
Yeah.
It just got to the point we complained to our consultant because they were why hasn't this been done? You'd be the patient was off in this separate building with overflow beds. And I was having a bleep every 2 minutes. I wrote down every time I got a bleep, here you go, you can have it. It was 112 in four hours, which is every 2 minutes. So if you answer all of them, you can't do any patient care.
No.
So I think that was the moment I first realised you could change little things because we then got a second person nights after that. But no, it was until really I came out of my shift recently and wrote that blog, that was the moment at which I went, I have now had it.
Yeah.
I think I came out, I'd had a really bad night shift and I paid £25 for my parking space because I didn't have a parking permit. I live 50 miles away and I wasn't eligible. I was on the
So give us
list.
The background.
Yeah.
So where were you at the time? I want the whole
story. So you were a registrar at this point.
So registrar.
Yeah.
So a few years into anaesthetics. Comfortable-ish with anaesthetics.
Yeah.
By the nature of the job, we're involved in emergencies. But when that's your bread and butter, you get a much calmer about emergencies. Uh-huh. But I started in a new hospital at night.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been to the department before. Mm-hmm. My swipe card wasn't working yet.
Classic.
I didn't know where things like the blood fridge were.
Mm-hmm.
And they do try and show you these things on induction, but you can't in a quick sort of spin tour when you're then going to rely on that a few hours later.
Yeah.
And also in that place, maternity is in a different building. So if you need any backup overnight, they are 5-10 minutes physically away.
Oh, wow. Mm.
Which in terms of an airway, time
is
money.
Is too much time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So naturally, because it was my first night, it was really busy. I then at 1 a.m. had this...
Had you started on nights?
Started on... My first shift was a night shift.
This story is getting worse and
worse.
Exactly.
Yeah. In a new building. Yeah. I didn't even know how to bleep anyone.
Yeah.
So this lady was having a C-section.
Yeah.
It had gone on for hours because I couldn't control the bleeding due to some medical comorbidities that she had. So the spinal anaesthetic wears off, they'll last an hour and a half or so, and then you're pushing it. So we're 2 hours in, so my spinal had done quite well, to be fair.
Yeah. It had held its ground.
It had done what it was meant to do, and then needed to put her off to sleep.
Yeah.
So tried to intubate her. Couldn't. The eye gel, which is our backup airway, didn't even work either. So by this point, you are starting to, that's when you call for your backup, when your first sort of attempt fails. And I had preemptively tried to call down the hill, but they were busy with another case.
Mm.
But I said, I'm going
to... Is it literally down the hill?
It's literally down the hill.
Oh, my gosh.
It's quite a long
way. So they have to come uphill as well, do you?
Uphill.
That's a struggle.
I've tried to do it before. I can't run up there. And I run 10 miles for fun. So
okay, that
it's,
says a lot.
It's properly steep.
That almost sounds like a horror movie, but you're saying
that. Yeah. So,
the setup just makes no sense.
It's
but anyways,
ridiculous.
That's life.
So that... And then I was trying to... you know, just maintain an airway and oxygenate, which I could do, but it wasn't safe. It was literally a face mask.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
you needed to get in a definitive.
Yeah. The big cause of sort of maternal problems is aspirating. So that's when your stomach contents come up into your airway, which was not protected by what I was doing.
Mm.
So the team didn't know me very well. They were clearly very stressed, the obs and gyne team. So they're like, can we just go in? Can we just go in? You're oxygenating.
Yeah.
So again, you've got all this human factors stuff. You've got equipment failures, like... I literally am
on your own
control. And so eventually we managed to sort it. Second reg came up, everything was sorted, but we were on that table like 5 hours and I'd used every unit of blood in the place because I was not in the central blood bank. You know, my major hemorrhage call took about an hour and 20 minutes for the blood to arrive.
Yeah.
So bearing in mind your blood flow to your uterus at
I was going to say, what can you do?
700 mils a minute.
Yeah.
That's how fast.
What can you do?
You basically put it in and it's just hosing out.
Yeah, so what you do is obviously you... can use sort of your adjuncts to try and control their blood pressure. So things like phenylephrine for the doctors. And then you can give things to try and squeeze the womb and the surgeons can try and get control.
Yeah.
And I gave her platelets because that's what she needed in that moment. But it's a very, obviously a very stressful situation.
Yeah, and on a personal level, I think also, like, it's very difficult as an anaesthetist when you've got no one else with you because it's just you.
Yeah, it's just you.
I mean, even from the surgical side, like from the obs and gynae side, you've got... your reg, your SHO, your consultant probably be there for an unwell patient.
Yeah.
So actually you've got a team of people that probably know each other, probably work together, are on the same page.
Yeah.
And usually when you're in a sort of a unit where you've been there for a while, you know your anaesthetist very well. So you also, that relationship extends. But you're on your first night shift there. You must have felt so alone.
Yeah, this is my first shift in this place. I couldn't even, I didn't know how to bleep anyone, you know. Yeah. And my swipe card didn't get me through the doors. You know, just really ridiculous things.
Yeah.
That, you know, my job is stressful enough without having to deal with these things that, you know, they've known I've been going for 6 months.
Yeah.
You know, can they not prepare you for your first shift?
Yeah.
So anyway, this was all fine. You know, I did my handover in the morning and I kind of said, you know, I had a really busy night. And they were like, and they, you know, it was nice.
Yeah.
And then the problem was that I had to then go out, and because I didn't have a parking permit, I just had to use the local city parking.
Yeah.
So overnight was £25.
That's unbelievable.
This is still what, that is the moment I was like, nope. I am worth more than this. I just, no, I'm not going to do it.
This is ridiculous.
Like, I love that it was, you know, 10 years of drama came to a head in that one moment.
Yeah.
I almost didn't pay it. I was like, the ticket is £30.
Yeah.
Like,
whatever.
You know, take a fiver.
That's on me.
Exactly. And then I just thought, oh God, I've got to go back and do it all again.
Yeah.
And I think it was trying to sleep after that where I came out with this blog post and just wrote, you know, all the stupid things that have ever
happened. Did you literally write the blog post there and then? Or was that
So I think I got home and it was like the day or 2 days later. I think I must have just finished nights and then been struggling to sleep, trying to reset my clock. And I remember it really vividly being like 3 a.m. and that's when, you know, I just churned it out in a wave of like hysteria that you can tell from the writing that I was clearly emotional.
100%.
And then so that's what I tweeted, and then you know, other people obviously felt it and just sort of started writing back. But I think what was very clear is, although, you know, obviously my experience was stupid and stressful, you know, people have been undergoing like genuinely nasty work experiences.
And like,
I'm sure you've both heard.
Yeah, even from reading the comments on the Facebook post, like, it's unbelievable. And I think you also put out like some highlights.
Yeah,
I mean, you can call it really,
no,
you should call it perhaps lowlights, but you know, some key sort of stories.
Definitely.
So what were things that really stuck out to you, things that really embedded in your mind?
So obviously I actually, like, it's very emotional reading those stories, and it's even more emotional being the one that's being messaged with them, because you know, you guys and like the media will have seen the facts, but you didn't see the conversations. Some of these people are suicidal.
Some
of them have left, they've gone to Canada. Some people have been really quite traumatised for a very long time by these things. You know, they're, so one that really sticks by me was this F1 just saying, I'm on a train, I'm crying, I don't want to go back to work tonight. And, you know, I spent a few hours chatting to her.
Yeah.
There was one, it was appalling. Her, basically, her grandmother was poorly and dying, and they wouldn't release her from her shift, so she'd go and see her before she died.
Yeah.
And then when she did die... and she wanted the funeral off, they made her bring in the death certificate.
Like,
I just, I don't understand
that
how
makes
you
no
be
sense.
That ridiculous.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It doesn't make sense.
No.
And I think that, and, you know, there are people working through miscarriages. They had a miscarriage at work, bleeding at work.
Yeah.
and the consultant being like, well, you can't do anything about it. So someone crashing on their way to work and being made to do their shift still. And then someone else found out this is one who'd just quit. She found out basically she had cancer on shift because she'd had a bit of a chest infection and then sort of deteriorated at work. They did a chest x-ray and found this really ominous thing. And she finished her shift. And I think initially, when the first couple of stories, you feel like, well, this is someone with an axe to grind, like, you know, or they might be like the odd character. But the way that they flooded in, like 400 in like two or 3 days, clearly this is a problem. Like, you can't ignore, like, if people are motivated enough to send you a stranger a message like that.
Yeah, sharing such a personal thing.
It's real.
Yeah. And it's systemic, right? Yeah. It's showing that it's not just in one place, in one area. It's and across the board.
Exactly. Because that was the point. I was like, God, this is A, terrible.
Yeah.
B, you know, you can go to individual departments. You can go to trusts. You can go to boards. You can go to deaneries. But I was like, this is national. Like, so that's the point. I was like, who looks after everything? It's the GMC. And I think that's the point I started advertising for stories. Up until then, these were just
coming into
just coming in. And then I was like, God, this is a full-time job now. You know, amazing. Like, you feel very privileged, but you're still up till 2 a.m. in the morning trying to stop people being suicidal, aren't you? And that's not my job either.
It's such a pressure on you.
So,
like,
can I ask, how did you deal with all of that? Because it must have been a lot to get so much coming at you. Or do you think you did, or what would you have done differently?
To be honest, I don't think I did. I think, although I was over, like, so I'd had some post-traumatic stress a few months before all of that happened.
Yeah.
You know, I hadn't taken a single day off, but I saw just a very sad case at work, and the consultant had been very distressed. It was about 2 a.m, and the consultant had to go, had to be picked up by their partner because they came out crying. So we sort of dealt with this case, and then a few months later, my horse got put down, and I know what the trigger was. It was the drugs that they used for her were the drugs I'd had to use for this young patient who had their head bashed in by a car, effectively. And that sort of started to bring back flashbacks. But naturally, I went from my horse being put down, and then I went to work 2 hours later, then had to use the same drugs again.
And it's
so
just
I know
too
exactly
much.
What that trigger was. And then
much.
Your night shifts. And then got, you know, all the classic symptoms. So I was reading, actually, in the GMC Wellbeing Report that a third of surgeons get post-traumatic stress, which is interesting, because I've never mentioned or heard from another doctor until I did this that other people had. Very invasive imagery. You'd be sat talking to people and they would be dying in front of you, and you'd be like, can I just take a moment, please? So throughout all of that, it did go away. I spoke to my GP, but, you know, I didn't take a day off work. I didn't really tell anyone, which is not the right thing to do.
It's so ingrained in us,
Like, you just, I think absenteeism in doctors for illness is way below average. We just present, and that's not always to anyone's benefit. And now I wouldn't do the same, but that had been the background. So to then have all these other things afterwards, you know, that's the background to it. It's, you know, I really connected with these people sending me their stories, and I just saw it's so many of these things are avoidable. Like, we just, you know, you all have had shifts like this.
Definitely.
And I'm sure that you've thought about it, like, over, since you did the article. What are some of the things that you think have been really impactful, or we could change as a system?
So loads of things, and actually the more I spoke to people about this, the more I realised that, so I must emphasise there are loads of things going on that were already going on before we ever had this. But I didn't know about them, we weren't connected to them. So first of all, it's like the deaneries are probably, they have an occupational health unit, and they have lots of schemes, including self-referral to anyone who's struggling. A lot of people will tell everyone it's your educational supervisor, but a lot of, unfortunately, there are personality clashes with educational supervisors, and a lot of people have been
bullied. And there's also a lack of information by the educational supervisors as well.
We don't, you know, they don't know either, and it's not their job to be a counsellor on top of their clinical, you know, they
and
just need
like,
and they're also within the system, I suppose, as well.
So I think, and now we do have, like, wellbeing guardians, so actually they can now be emailed as a source of, like, the first step, which I think is good. And then the other resource that I think has come out that's really useful is a community. So they're called WARD. So that stands for Wellness and Resilience in Doctors. You know, I hate the word resilience. But these guys are fab. It was set up locally to me. It's now gone national. It's a registered charity.
Okay.
It was set up by some anaesthetist whose friend committed suicide.
Oh, wow.
And the idea is that you have someone with a visible lanyard on and who can be approached by anyone to say, I've divorced from my wife and I can't afford the mortgage, to I'm acutely suicidal, to they've started getting, you know, the acute psych teams to junior doctors at work.
Okay.
Because to try and intervene before they go home and do something.
Yeah.
So that was quite interesting. And then the other system things are just really simple. It's what we all know. And I think it's what's been in the GMC review recently. Can we have night parking so that we're not wandering around like...
Parking in £25 night car parks and
all unsafe car parks and spaces.
Dodgy places.
Like, a nurse had her tyres slashed in the staff car park, and then, you know, we're all finishing our shifts at like midnight sometimes and then have to walk around there. You hear people being...
No, 100%. Like, I had like parts nicked off my car like a couple of weeks ago, and I, you know, then you finished a long day and you're stranded for 5 hours trying to get towed home, and you're just like, got to be back at 8 a.m. tomorrow. This is wonderful.
It's ridiculous. And like, the car parks are empty at night.
Yeah.
Just give people night permits.
Just give them a spot. Right. Give them a spot.
And like, hot food. We all know that, you know, some people don't like eating at night.
Yeah.
The
crazies.
Yeah. Like, I hate that you can only get junk food, because I will eat it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're
hungry.
You're starving. You're doing a 12-hour shift. You can't just not eat for 12 hours.
Yeah.
Because actually you're going to do 4 days of that. So, you know, you can't starve yourself, can you? Well, I can't, personally. So I think that leads to, like, really bad habits. We all know that. Junk food makes you feel rubbish, and it's not good for your health if you're doing that for 40 years. The other suggestion I saw that was, I thought was brilliant, was I don't know how you guys feel about this, was instead of going day night shifts, you're staggered. So like, you'll do an afternoon and then an evening and then a night shift.
So I know they're really
similar to
A&E. I was going to say, they're really good at doing that in A&E.
Yeah,
but I also want some people, I think it's difficult because you have like a whole...
There'll be pros and cons.
Exactly. You've got a whole group of people, and some people will be really happy with it.
Yeah.
Some people need a more planful life
and
for
it's
their
like
children
a child
and family. So I'm also very aware that I only know what it's like to be like a single woman without children and like have enough, even being able to choose my shifts in locoming, that I'm not quite sure what other people's like responsibilities
commitments
and experiences are.
And I think that's
I think it's great to, we need to start thinking about these
things. And like, I think flexibility and being able to think about work plans, like every individual is in a different situation.
Absolutely.
So what the establishment is now starting to do is just come to the foreground and actually talk to people about what they want. Like, it seems revolutionary that we want parking and IT and hot food. You know, they
but people
think
have probably
want...
been saying this for God knows how many years.
And the message
But we say that they've been talking about, like, we've been talking about it. I just wonder if we have or if we're not that kind
not
of...
Not to
right.
the right people,
exactly.
necessarily.
I think internally we have, it's so obvious to us what the problem are, but, like, the GMC have had to employ a whole team of people to find out these things. I think the other really interesting thing that I think will be slightly controversial is, I don't know what it's...
Go on, contrary.
We might have a bit of controversy. So, you know, sort of restrooms or on-call facilities for doctors, a lot of trusts have scrapped them or are charging them because they feel, you know, whatever.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The restroom. rest shouldn't be taken at night or whatever these silly things are. I think there was also a trust that actually put their CCTV in the mess or something.
To catch people sleeping. What are they going to do with that?
I don't know. So that's a great way.
Prosecute you.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Do you know what? I'm so stubborn. It would make me just want to go, just be like, yeah. End those eyes.
Yeah.
Just keep my eyes closed.
Or just lay there and watch the CCTV like the whole time.
I mean, imagine yourself being in the reverse position management. Mm. It's not a great way to foster trust and loyalty.
No, yeah.
And I think when you use the whip, people will do enough.
Yeah.
But actually, if you get them motivated, if you say, you know what, I'm going to provide you a really nice room and some rest, you know, use it for your half an hour break, whatever, you're then not going to mind staying half an hour late. 100%. Doing these other 100%. Things.
I'm with you. Carrot, not the stick.
Exactly.
And I worked in New Zealand for a bit, and I always say that whenever anyone asks me about it, I'm like, the work is the same. Like, you're a doctor. It's still busy. There are patients. There are sick people. There's all sorts of stuff going on.
Mm.
But you are fed.
Yeah.
You have a bed.
Yeah.
And people know your name. Yeah. I found this mind-blowing. I would turn up on a ward, and it would be nurses I'd seen a month ago, and they'd be like, Suba. And I was like, tell me everything that you want me to do. Like, I will do anything. Like, do you want me to rewrite all these drug charts? I will. Like, that's all it takes. You know, it was so bizarre to me that I was there for 3 month rotations as well. They're not even 4 month rotations. Like, people know me by the end very well. People were encouraging and being like, you need to learn to do this. You want to do this specialty. Come on, why don't you put in the marina? Come on, you come in, you know, do the VE. You do things that are good for your progression. Mm. And I was so boggled. I was like, I've done this same job for 4 months in the UK and taken away so much less.
Yeah.
And no one's known my name.
Yeah.
And it's just so the little things that I think of it like as this wonderland. I'm like, New Zealand is amazing. Like, you know?
Exactly.
And it takes so little.
Yeah, I have two examples for this. So, like, one, I've been the most stressed in my life. I'd had this post-traumatic stress. I was coming in. I did, like, most of my neurosurgery unsupervised.
Wow.
I did my 60 hours a week. I did my competencies. Everyone said my portfolio was glowing.
Yeah.
And then it came to getting signed off from that hospital.
Mm.
And they're lovely, but their department is so big. The person signing me off goes, oh, sorry, we haven't met, have we? What's your name? And I'm like, you're the person that's, you know, this is my goodbye kind of session from the hospital, and you still don't know who I am. But my life has been in this hospital. Like, I've gone through so much, you know, by giving myself to this job.
Yeah.
And you still don't know me. And I think, and then what's the other one? I've done some lists with someone, quite a few lists. Mm. And I was their registrar. They were one of the consultants in the department.
Yeah.
And I was trying to get in a back door from the car park.
Yeah.
And said, oh, can you get in this way? And he was like, no, the public entrance is at the front.
What?
And I was just mortified.
I wouldn't even know what to do.
I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know what, this is
also hilarious because I have a very amusing story. When I was on A&E and I was coming in for a night shift or a late shift at like 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock something, and I was coming up the back entrance, or I was coming out, I think I was leaving, and there was this guy stood there who looked a little bit shady to me, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
And I was sort of like looking at him through the glass, and he was like looking at me through the glass. And I was like, sorry, who are you? And he was like, I'm the locum urology reg. And I was like, do you have any like identification? Like, how do I know that? And he's like, oh, like, I work here all the time. I was like, I've never seen you. And he was like, so can you let me in? And I was like, I mean, I don't feel like I should.
You're probably going to have to refer to him then.
I know. And I see him around and he hates me. But literally, I was kind of like, do you want to give me like a urology fact or something so I can buy into the story? And he's like, no, I'm not going to give you.
I'm going to kill you.
He was like, I'm going to report you. He was genuinely, I was like, just give me a urology fact. Like, what's the normal size of a prostate?
So funny.
And he was like, I'm not going to answer these questions. And then his SHO turned up and I was like, I'm out, I'm busy.
What do you reckon is the correct fact for an obs and gynae person to know? How would you know it's one of you?
I mean, to be honest, I've got a low bar. Like, if you tell me something vaguely convincing, like, okay, when would you give a prophylactic anti-D? Yeah. And they were like 28 weeks, I'd be like, you're with me. It's all right. I believe you're not a layman. Come on in. It could be a very well-read layman.
I was
going to
say, I might struggle with that question.
So. It could be somebody who's rhesus negative who just knows. And I would be like, yeah, welcome. Come on in. Let me help you. Here's the scrubs.
Shall I take your coat?
So it sounds like we're like calling for like a change of culture from hospitals.
Mm.
I always wonder, though, just because I myself and us ladies as doctors here, how do we get our colleagues also to change the culture? Because we are part of it and we are going to be the future leaders. Literally in like 10 years time, we'll all be like the consultants in the hospital. I wonder when, at what point do we need to like kind of take responsibility as a collective and like what sort of ways you think you've seen have been useful? Like, I love the example you gave about the ward, the WARD lanyard. I think that's great.
Yeah, they have a website and are national, everybody.
How do you find them? Just like Google WARD. Yeah. What's the mnemonic again?
WARD. So it's WARD.
What does it stand for?
So mean? Wellness and Resilience for Doctors.
Wellness and Resilience for Doctors. Okay, we got it.
Yeah. They're brilliant. Mm-hmm. They'll do anything for you.
No, but following on from what Amelie was saying, so obviously...
It was a question, I'm not going to lie.
What do you think? So how do we get our peers to engage in forming groups of sort of expressing our voices and saying what our concerns are and try and make that into cultural change? How do we do that?
Yeah, no, this is an interesting one because I have found it interesting. People, we all like to complain, but we're not very necessarily good at providing solutions. And I read this really interesting quote the other day. I'm a big sort of classics fan as well, being a science geek. But it was, I think it was Cicero. So he was sort of a Roman Stoic and sort of a philosophist, ethicist. And he said that what motivates men, I mean, we're women, but that's humanity, is being fed the glory of, like, public service. That will motivate you to do public service if you're rewarded for it, which isn't necessarily financial. So we need to elevate people that support these cultures instead of people that just want to get ahead. And then the other part of that quote was, or if they are being inspired by people for whom they have affection.
Okay,
there are like so there's a role model issue and I think they are there, you know, and
often, and a mentorship issue
I think mentorship comes back to, you know, when what we were saying about what the reasons I enjoyed Oxford. If you have people that you are have affection for, we all know, like, what it's nice to work with a nice colleague, isn't
100%,
it?
Yeah,
you know, or a nice boss or one
someone
that
you look up to and you admire as well.
Exactly. So what really turned my whole head around with was role models, and actually in some there are a lot of, you know, guys, there are a lot of women, and it's not just a one sex thing, but I think sometimes woman to woman it can feel more powerful. So this is the president of the Royal College of Pathologists.
She's so cool.
She is lush and she's
she's so cool.
She sent me her number and I went to hang out with her for a day in London. She bought me breakfast, she bought me lunch, she showed me cutting up an ovary, she showed me loads of microscopes. Side. She took me to meetings to show me what sort of
medical directors. Yeah, sounds amazing.
I would love to be a pathologist. She did well. But, you know, and she told me, you know, she'd had years out, she's had time, she wasn't sure.
Yeah.
And I had so many other people invite me to their labs. I got someone that invited me to the human centrifuge where they do some of the space medicine and military stuff. And people who took me out to do, like, sports medicine. So it's up north somewhere. I can't remember the name of the town. It's, like, off in the woods somewhere. But offers to go on a diving thing. And I just think, you know what, you can put up with anything.
Yeah.
If you're inspired.
Yeah.
And I think that we're all just driven to, like, fill out tick boxes and these portfolios. Like, there's no
And there's a degree of that passion. There's a degree of that that's a necessary evil. I get that they do need to see you're progressing. That. They need to see you're achieving your competencies.
But that shouldn't be where it ends.
No.
Can't we inspire each other instead?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like, a huge part of what brings us into medicine or an interest in science is appreciation for the wonder, right? Like, the art side of it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as much as I always think of doctors as the slightly arty scientists, we're on that sort of slightly more artistic side, which is where the sort of, you know, the art of medicine and patient care comes in, because you can know the practicalities and science well, but miss the kind of the grey stuff in between, right? And that's so important for us to foster, and people that, you know, if we're not fostering that, you're gonna lose people. Like, that's inevitable. That's so inevitable.
Just be nice, take on first years, inspire them. Yeah. I've, like, got some first year medical students now who are passing death on WhatsApp. They're so cute because they think medicine is great.
Yeah.
One of them got upset the other day and thought, you know, it was all doom and gloom, so I had to have a chat with her.
But I think that's also great as well from their point of view. Like, I always
it's realistic.
It is realistic, and the thing is, when I keep saying, taking it back to like the responsibility of the individual, not to say that we should have resilience, I think it's also important when, and my dad also encourages me always to do this, he's like, whenever you start a new placement, find out who your natural mentor is.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be the most senior person in the department.
That's
it can
really
just
good.
Be a reg that you find, you think
somebody
they're so flipping
with.
Cool.
Yeah.
Like, this is the kind of doctor you want to be with.
Yeah.
And ask them to help you.
Yeah.
Because more times than none, they're going to want to help and nurture you.
We enjoy it, don't we?
Yeah.
We enjoy helping. That's what got us into this.
Absolutely.
In the first place.
And you just saying that you have a WhatsApp group with five, like, first years. I'm sure if anyone came and asked any of us,
we
would absolutely all do it. So
absolutely.
I think it's also great for, like, even our listeners and people who are, like, quite juniors. We have lots of medical students, lots of juniors through the ranks. It's about asking people.
Yeah, just go and ask for help.
Yeah.
Or can, if you see something cool, or can I come to clinic with you on Friday?
Yeah.
Or, oh, you're doing this operation,
can I come
see it?
Yeah. Or reinforce, like, positively, like, what has happened.
Yeah, I think so, because when you think about sort of the history of medicine, it's very much learning elbow to elbow, isn't it? You used to be apprentice. You go around with someone for 5-6 years and you sort of inherit their role and stuff the same way as like blacksmiths and farriers do now, right?
Yeah.
And that's been lost a bit, partly because we move around so much and everything's been made more formalised.
Mm-hmm.
So you've lost some of those personal relationships, which were also supportive in terms of sort of...
they were relationships.
Yeah.
They are. And then you feel like recognised and valued as a student or as a junior.
Yeah.
And your contributions, someone also knows where you're at, what your progress is, because that's such a big thing too, isn't it? Like, in a culture where every day, if you're with a new senior, they don't know what your competence levels are.
No.
They don't know what you can do, what you can't do. And every morning you're having that same conversation where they're like, so where are you at? And you're like, I can do this, or I can do that, or I'm confident doing this. And
you're so right. We often don't introduce ourselves. We'll say our name and our job role, but then we don't say, oh, you know, and I like horse riding, or I'm really interested in X or Y, or can you tell me more about this today? I would love that if someone did that.
Yeah, 100%.
I think the other thing as well is something I've been like really keen to kind of show is like I'm a classic example of I had a really bad day at work. I got really cross about the parking. I'm still really cross about the
parking. I'm crossing your behalf.
And actually that has now escalated to the point where I've collected enough stories that it's formed part of a GMC review. I am an average doctor with an averagely crap day, you know. I haven't even had, you know, these awful things happen to me, and like it's gone this far. And I think if you get the bit between your teeth and you want to change something, I would say people are really receptive. I was shocked. I did not get doors slammed in my face. I had the GMC were receptive when I emailed them. The Department of Health contacted me. The deaneries were lovely. Anyone I spoke to say, can I come and spend an afternoon with you, were lovely. Like, you just have to... I think the problem is there's a lot of lobbying and a lot of politics surrounding the NHS and medicine, particularly since all the contract stuff. And there's a lot of anger and frustration both sides. And of course we need lobbying and people pushing and campaigning. But I think it can be quite annoying to be on the other side of aggression. So if you have someone quiet and interested and sort of who's got a bit of evidence, who just comes and says, can I talk to you about this? Because... no one finds that offensive or difficult, and that has worked for me. I have not gone out, you know, aggressively to try and get anyone in trouble or say how, you know, it is awful, but I've also been trying to say, can we change it? Like, and I think you sometimes having a slightly softer approach or a more integrative sort of teamwork, collaborative working approach rather than us versus GMC, us versus them, is how a lot of this has happened, I think.
And so much of what, you know, the GMC Wellbeing Report, which you put me onto, and I sort of read half
it's
of it
brilliant.
On the tube,
it's so
amazing.
Good.
Like, I love that even the fact that they say we shouldn't aim for resilience, we should aim to make the workplace...
Did you write that, Jo?
I was like, I hate the word resilience.
Was you? Oh my
well,
God, Jo, get
everyone
out.
Everyone keeps telling
I'm
me
joking,
that.
I'm
Actually, I friggin' loved it. Now I friggin' love that you know, that sort of sentence. But
was it you that wrote it though?
I didn't write it. I had some input. I think most people they interviewed will have said exactly
Absolutely.
The same
things. Yeah. But what I loved about the GMC report was that, you know, they sort of talk about how they use the three, like the ABC, right? We love a good ABC.
Oh, we love a good ABC.
What was it, like autonomy? Belonging and
competence.
And he talks so much about compassionate leadership, which I loved, because don't you feel like sometimes in hospitals there's an attitude of like the doctors that become clinical leaders are like these career chasers that actually are just climbing.
Well, that's what we think about them sometimes.
That's what I mean. It shouldn't be that way. I mean, we shouldn't maybe that's true, maybe that's not true.
That's what I've learned. So I think there are, I remember being told once when I was really upset by one of the educational leads, there are hawks and there are doves.
Hawks and doves.
And that person is a hawk. And you're just like, really?
Oh, come on, is it that binary?
Yeah.
It's not that binary.
It's like when you talked about the Royal College of Pathology
and the
colleges. And I think of like some of the presidents, and mainly because they're all women, or they were women in the past like 2 years. They're absolutely amazing, and I think it is that compassionate, like, leadership style. Not because they're women, because they're all very strong.
Yeah.
But I think it's because with compassion comes human story.
Yeah.
And then you understand, okay, this is my workforce.
Yeah.
And I think as women, we have the special skills that we've, like, been socialised to form.
Yeah.
To understand, like, the groups that we work with.
Absolutely.
And so I think what we really saw from all of those college leaders, including, like, Leslie Regan, including...
Shout out to my lady.
What's the Royal College of Physicians? I've forgotten her name. That's annoying. Anyway, I've forgotten her name, but she's so cool. Jane something, maybe?
Dacra?
Yes.
Jane Dacra. Okay.
Yeah. So,
I never met her. But
yeah, she always talks about like quiet leadership and how power can also come from, even if your personality is different to what they say the male, like male aggressive leadership is.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. And that galvanising human story.
Yeah. I think it's better, isn't it? You want to like lead with the pack because you understand the pack.
Yeah.
You just sit at the top and govern.
Yeah.
Like you're never going to get the most out of people just by driving them. You're going to have to show them a vision and try and get them there.
Yeah.
And I think that is becoming more popular now in every aspect
in all,
of life.
In all industries as well, right?
Like, but I love how you've created a forum for it. Because I think sometimes you think we have to become those, like, the top tier leaders.
Mm.
But clearly what you've also shown from your work, and I know it didn't start off that way, was you using the resources available to you. So that's you using your blog post and, like, tweeting it and sharing a really vulnerable, honest story. I think that's so dope that you were able to do that because it's shown all of us who share very similar, like, experiences.
That's like everyone understood how it felt. You know, I think, I think that moment was coming. I think a lot of people were saying it. We all sit around after work and in the mess and complain about these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, people hadn't read my... You know, I had my blog at uni because I was editor for, like, the science magazine.
Cute.
For Imperial.
Oh, my God. I actually love you. You're actually such a geek. I feel like... even Imperial's like is science
Imperial
geeky,
super geeky.
Once I wrote a blog post that Sir Robert Winston, you know, child of our time, commented on.
No, he didn't.
Yeah,
that is your claim to fame.
That I can die happy.
Yeah, you're done.
Put that on your gravestone.
Yeah, my epitaph.
What did he say?
He just said, "Spot on or off, you're a caterpillar."
Amazing.
So I got to interview some really cool people.
That would have carried me through a whole decade.
That's the thing, right? Like, literally. And I put that on my red application. You know, I printed off the tweet and put it in my anaesthetic application.
If you saw my portfolio, it's hilarious. It's literally just like tweets, projects I've done. I'm like, I'm making like impact. It might not be the way you think it is, but it's cool.
And when I think, you know, how happy that made me, and how happy as well, I was really terrified of the press attention, because you can get in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, and they get, you know, you're worried about how things might be
perceived.
Yeah,
and also my trust is lovely, and all the people in my trust are not in themselves nasty. They're just busy.
Yeah,
I did not want to get anyone in trouble. I wasn't out there to blame. I was just saying this is a bad system.
Yeah.
Can we change the system?
What was the response you got from your trust and people?
They were lovely. So I was very apprehensive.
Why are you so sure?
How did it come out? Was it one day you came to Handover and someone was like,
people talking about you?
Yeah, a lot. So all of a sudden I had a lot of emails. So first of all, my mum was stressing out because she's an NHS manager. And she was like, don't do it. She was like, everyone's going to know who you are. The chief exec is going to come and find you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like, she was really stressing me out.
Yeah.
Thanks, mum.
Shout out to mama.
So I got quite stressed. And then I told, so Jo Martin, the Royal College of Pathologists lady, I told her that this Guardian thing was kind of happening. And that was a complete accident. I did not set out to get the press.
Yeah.
But the press were interested, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
And she was like, talk to your press office at the hospital. Like, they will have rules.
Okay.
But try and involve them.
Yes.
But if you get in trouble for this, like, I will be behind you. I will fight for you. The Royal Colleges will release a statement about how awful all of this is, and we'll support you.
Oh, which is great.
Like,
yeah.
What a tiger.
I think I would have cried.
Yeah. Like, literally.
That's amazing.
So emotional. And that is the kind of support I've had all the way through.
That's amazing.
But it's not just for me, is it? This is the support all of us have.
Yeah.
If you just reach out.
That's so important to hear that. I feel like you need to say that again. Because I feel like that's so important for people hearing.
Yeah.
Who are, like, vibing with what we're talking about and feeling like they want to you know, implement changes in their own trust, in their own hospitals, yeah, to hear that
people will change. They want to, yeah, know what
and
you think.
And people will support you. Yeah. Like, you don't need to be afraid that if you put yourself out there that you're going to take the fall, yeah, for it, or that you're going to get gunned down with people saying, why, yeah, are you raising these issues?
You know, there is nothing more inspiring you can hear than, yeah, I will fight for you. Like, yeah, how often, yeah, do you hear that outside of movies?
Literally never. Yeah.
It's just...
It's that's what you and that's what you need to know, is that there are people out there that will absolutely back you,
yeah,
and give you that support and have your back, yeah, basically.
And it was nearly all positive, and everyone I worked with,
yeah,
just was like, yes, this is what we've
that's
been
so
trying
great.
To say for ages.
And I love that we've met you just after this report has come out, and
yeah,
after all this great work that's like come from the fruition.
I was
of
so
article.
Emotional yesterday when
you must
you,
have been
because it's proper. It's like actually what we care about.
It is literally. I've been good. Reading it and I've just been like trying not to do amens on the train.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
like
yeah, yeah,
sat
yeah.
there with people around me.
It's like, almost like
okay.
they've just given me a filtered version of like what I said, and then the real one. It's like
yeah, yeah, yeah. taking out the expletives.
Fine.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's
so,
it's great.
I feel like this has had to change your view of what you see your career doing now. Can I just ask, like, what, personally, the next steps are for you? Not,
yeah.
like, I hope that's not a pressure.
No, no, so
pressure.
I think, so I'm super geeky. I'd really like to try
as
and
we
get
know.
Established,
as we know.
Fit a PhD in.
And
yeah,
guys,
not
sorry,
surprised.
Because people can't actually see you here, you literally look like Elle Woods from Legally Blonde.
Yeah.
So it actually blows my mind that you're such a little geek.
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to try and do a PhD.
Yeah.
And then I'll stick with anaesthetics for now, but I'm just... I want to go rediscover the sort of love and the wonder, and I must shout out again to Charlotte Summers from Cambridge, who invited me to her lab to like talk about all of this, like
uh-huh.
unprompted again, like just lovely, really,
yeah.
really wonderful, amazing
good woman.
She's so successful, you know, she's head of academic medicine at Cambridge.
Yeah,
yeah.
She's really nice.
Yeah.
You can have it all. You
yeah.
don't have to stand on others
nope.
to get to the top of the pyramid.
Yeah,
you can let them help you up
mm-hmm.
and take them up with you. So. And then I'd like to see if I can do more with some more of the sort of humane culture stuff, just because I feel I've had the experience now.
Mm.
I'm not someone that is naturally very vocal. I'm quite, you know, my mum always said I never liked talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not confrontational. So this has been completely out of my comfort zone.
Mm.
But I feel like I've learnt things that are useful
yeah.
to other people. And I think when people have an example of someone that can change things
mm-hmm.
just because they had a crap day and didn't want to pay for their parking,
mm-hmm.
just to go back to that, really crossed at it, then that will hopefully encourage other people that you can do something about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And where can people find your blog before we close off?
Mm.
So I think it's curiosityclan
okay.
at wordpress.com.
Mm-hmm.
But
love
I'll
it.
Put it on my Twitter.
Yeah, curiosity can. And what's your Twitter, Joe, if you quickly shout that
so
out to us?
So it's at Jopo, J-O-P-O,
yeah.
899.
Yeah.
So Jopo 899.
And don't be fooled, there is another Joanna Poole on Twitter
yeah,
who
that's
I always
like
messaged.
My, is there?
Yeah. Before I found you and I was like,
I wonder how many she's received.
Yeah, she probably gets, people are probably sending her like stories of difficulties at work
yeah.
and she's just like, oh, it's people.
No joke, she's probably going to write a book about it if you don't get there first. So, with all the stories that she's probably received in her inbox. So,
okay, so signing off with a little excerpt from Jo's blog.
I'm not depressed. I wouldn't give it up, but I am tired that medicine in the UK at the moment has created a system that is systematically designed to separate us from our real lives, erode the mentor-trainee relationship, move us around hundreds of miles and perform a constant circus of acid rain on our self-esteem, deep-rooted desire to please, and ability to conduct ourselves as a daughter, partner, or parent. I accept that for healthcare you do just have to sacrifice, but realistically there is a fleet of small inconsequential things, like the omission of small talk, that would transform my world were they to undergo a humane metamorphosis.
Thank you, Jo.
Thank you so much, Jo.
Right.
It's been so
I
lovely meeting
it.
You.
Can I stay?
Please, please. Forever. Let's just move into the wing, because
yeah.
it's so gorgeous.
Yeah, it's lush here.
Absolutely. I feel like all we came to do was talk about what had happened with your journey, but I think we've come left with so much more
yeah.
and I hope that people feel galvanised by this conversation and a bit more powerful.
Yeah, like if you don't like something, change it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And even
yeah.
if your power doesn't look like what you think power
yeah.
is.
Should look like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've got it if you've got
100%.
A thing that you want to change.
100%. And actually that frustration is enough to take you to where you want to get to.
Yeah.
That's all you need.
Yeah.
Use that frustration.
Use it. Diesel fuel.
100%.
She's going to say something about car parking.
Yeah.
So, signing off, guys. Thank you so much for listening today. And check out JoePo899.
Yeah, this has been great.
Catch you on the
next episode. Bye. Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.